Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. We're lucky to be joined by Doug Palmer, Politico's trade reporter, a man who's forgotten more about trade than most of us will ever know. Doug, thanks again for joining us on Politico Money.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Ben. Thanks for having me.
The book is a work of fiction. If you look back at Woodward's past, he had the same problem with other presidents. He likes to get publicity.
I want to go to Bob Woodward's new book, which is out this week. In fact, I think out officially today. Everybody lining up at the bookstores for their copy of his book, which is called Fear, all about the inside machinations of the Trump White House. And it relies a lot on interviews with Gary Cohn, the former National Economic Council director, former president of Goldman Sachs. And there's a lot of juicy stuff in there about Gary, and most of it revolves around trade. And I know Gary pretty well. I've known him for a long time. He and I talked a lot during the early days of the administration, and he was pretty freaked out on a consistent basis that Trump would unilaterally pull out of NAFTA, also freaked out that he would unilaterally pull out of a trade agreement with South Korea. And in the book, he takes some pretty dramatic steps to stop that. And Woodward reports that Cohn basically swiped multiple official documents off of the president's desk. And this is including letters that would take the U.S. out of NAFTA and out of CORUS, which is the acronym for the South Korean trade deal. None of that was a huge surprise to me, maybe that he would take that dramatic of a step to basically steal papers from the president. Did that surprise you, the account of how Gary was maneuvering to stop a unilateral NAFTA withdrawal?
You know, I remember vividly the day, I think back in April 2017, where Trump was supposedly getting ready to withdraw from NAFTA. You know, me and other people at Politico were getting, you know, emails from one of our White House reporters at the time saying that he's going to do it. And I remember like texting back like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Why would he do that? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it turned out to be true that he was withdrawing, and there was this big, huge effort to persuade him otherwise. I mean, the story that day, as I recall, was like Sonny Perdue came in with these maps of the United States showing all these congressional districts where Trump had won. And, you know, they're all, you know, a lot of them are like rural congressional districts where, you know, farmers voted for him. And, you know, and they tried to persuade him like, well, look, you know, if you withdraw from NAFTA, you're just going to be hurting your supporters out there in farm country. So, I mean, so that was kind of the detail that I remember at the time. And it was until the Bob Woodward book, it wasn't reported the story of Gary Cohn taking the documents off his desk. That particular detail was kind of a little like, yeah, like, wow, he really did that. He went that far to actually take it off of the president's desk. So, yeah, along with everybody else, I was surprised to find out about that.
Yeah, when I think about that, I mean, obviously it's a dramatic move by Gary to, you know, take documents from the president's desk and make it more difficult for him to pull out of NAFTA. But, you know, when I think about it, I think that if President Trump had simply, you know, made the decision firmly, look, I'm pulling out of NAFTA, and wanted to do it, he would have just said, you know, give me the paperwork, let me sign the letter, I'm going to do it. Like, there had to be at some point some kind of decision that he made to listen to Gary and to Perdue and to other members of Congress who said, look, man, if you pull out of NAFTA unilaterally, the markets are going to tank. It's going to be a economic disaster. All of our exports to Canada will be blown up, and we export a ton to Canada. We have an integrated supply chain with Mexico where we bring auto parts in to finish our autos that we then export. Like, at some level, he must have decided that, okay, maybe unilateral withdrawal isn't the right idea. Like, it wasn't just a piece of paper that he couldn't sign. I mean, do you think I'm reading that right?
Well, no, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, and that's sort of consistent with the reporting at the time, where there was this moment where he seemed to be on the verge of doing it, but he was persuaded by his advisors not to do it, or at least the free trade advisors, you know, won the day that day. But, you know, with President Trump, it always seems like you can win a victory one day only to have to fight the battle all over again another day.
All right. So let us set the stage for why we are talking to you and what's going on with NAFTA negotiations. I should note to listeners, we're recording this on Tuesday, September 11th. Chrystia Freeland, the Canadian foreign minister, is back in Washington for talks on NAFTA and hoping to get Canada involved in a deal. So this is a very fluid situation. Things could change by the hour. There's pressure to get a deal done on NAFTA by the end of this month. So forgive us if there have been developments in the next 12, 18 hours before this drops into your inboxes, but we'll try to get you up to speed on exactly what is happening. So the U.S. versus Canada, the strange case of the United States versus Canada on trade and the weird situation we find ourselves in which we're fighting with our neighbor to the north, who we've always had very cordial relations with, and kind of nobody thought we would be in this knockdown dragout with the Canadians over milk, but that's where we are. And Chrystia Freeland, who was my former boss at the FT, actually she was the U.S. managing editor when I was at the FT, and I got to know her pretty well, and she's definitely tough, and obviously in this situation is not really showing a whole lot of flexibility on dairy, but it's really about that. So tell me if you were in the room right now with Chrystia Freeland and Bob Lighthizer, what are they arguing about?
Well, I think they're arguing about how much Canada is going to open its markets to U.S. dairy exports. Canada has a supply management system to help support prices for dairy farmers in Canada. I mean, and so a supply management system means you manage the supply. You restrict how much can be produced. You restrict how much can be imported in order to support the price. And so if U.S. dairy farmers had unfettered access to the Canadian market, it would destroy that supply management system. And really, when it comes to agriculture, this is kind of the only area where Trump can say I've improved NAFTA, versus the previous deals. I mean, there are other provisions in there that are helpful for agriculture, but in terms of market access, this is where he can say that I've improved NAFTA versus the original deal, because the original deal basically got rid of all tariffs between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. So for most agricultural products, there's duty-free trade between the three countries. But, Canada still has a supply management for dairy, poultry, eggs. And, there's sort of an expectation that this time around, the U.S. is going to get more from Canada than it gave in the original NAFTA agreement.
Yeah, let's talk about the power dynamic here between the U.S. and Canada as these negotiations are playing out, because it seems like the Canadians are playing hardball on milk. They don't want to give up the protections for their dairy industry. And Chrystia has said repeatedly that she's a big supporter of Canadian farmers and dairy farmers, and is not willing to give up the protections. And Justin Trudeau has said basically the same thing. So they don't want to move. But Trump has said in response, if you don't, I'm going to slap 25% tariffs on all the cars you export to the United States. And I've been doing some reporting around Trump administration officials and the back and forth with the Canadians. And, their belief is that doing that would be an existential threat to the Canadian economy. They basically think they've got the upper hand here and Canada's going to have to cave on milk eventually. Do you think that's right, that the U.S. has the whip hand here and the Canadians are going to have to, come to heel and allow us to sell them more milk?
Well, I think they always realized that they were going to have to do something on dairy. Again, the question is just how much they have to do and what will the U.S. settle for and what can Canada justify to its farmers as saying, this is the price of the agreement in order to preserve the relationship and all the other economic benefits we get from NAFTA. We have to give something. We have to give something on dairy. I think that they are concerned about the prospect of a 25% tariff on their auto exports to the United States, but they're not the only people that are concerned about that. I mean, U.S. auto manufacturers are concerned about that because they have production facilities in Canada that produce autos for the U.S. market. And, members of Congress are concerned about the idea of imposing a 25% duty on auto imports from Canada or any other country that Trump has mentioned.
Let's not go too deep into Chapter 19 because people's ears will glaze over, but it is an issue here, the idea of an independent arbitrator, which was in the initial NAFTA, and Canada wants it to stay in NAFTA, and the U.S. wants to throw it out. Why is this such a big deal?
Right. Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it is a bit nerdy, so bear with us. But you know, basically every country, including the United States, has the right to impose anti-dumping or anti-subsidy duties on imports that they feel are unfairly traded. And, you know, Canada, being a neighbor of the United States, trades a lot with the United States and is often on the receiving end of these anti-dumping and countervailing duties. So in the original U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, which predated NAFTA by a number of years, they insisted on including this provision, which has come to be known as Chapter 19 because that's simply the name of the chapter where it's housed, that sets up sort of a bilateral forum. So if Canada feels like the U.S. has unfairly applied these anti-dumping and countervailing duties, it can appeal to this forum and potentially get them overturned. And they've used this forum in cases involving U.S. duties on Canadian softwood lumber. That's been a particular bone of contention between the two countries. And they've been successful, and the U.S. kind of finds that irritating. And it's interesting that, you know, Bob Lighthizer is a lawyer who specializes in bringing anti-dumping and countervailing duty cases. He worked for U.S. Steel as an outside attorney where he did a lot of that. And, you know, many other officials at USTR and many other Trump administration officials at USTR are former, members of the trade bar where they brought these anti-dumping and countervailing duty cases. And so I think that they just, don't really like the idea of this bilateral forum out there that can overturn a U.S. government decision. And so they've proposed eliminating it as part of the new agreement. And they have some support in Congress from some members who feel like Chapter 19 has not been that good for the United States.
Gotcha. All right. So one last sticking point are other exemptions to NAFTA, particularly regarding Canadian cultural protections. And this is an interesting one. Trump wants them out. Canada wants to keep them in. These are barriers that protect Canadian cultural industries from being swamped by U.S. entertainment giants. And basically, the reason that some of the most popular entertainment brands in Canada are virtually unknown in the United States. So what is the deal with Canadian cultural protections, and how is that holding up a deal with the Canadians?
It certainly is an issue that USTR has highlighted in its annual reports. I mean, every year they put out this thing called the National Trade Estimate, and they, go through 60-odd countries and they highlight what they think are the biggest trade barriers in that country. And in that report, it talks specifically about, Canada's telecommunications barriers. You know, despite steps to partially liberalize, I'm quoting from the report, despite steps to partially liberalize the market through the 2012 revision to the Telecommunications Act, Canada continues to possess one of the most restrictive telecommunication regimes among developed countries. You know, and so they have like foreign ownership caps, like on cable TV stations. A foreigner can't own more than 46% of a Canadian cable company. There's other kind of quirky things in their law where I guess 35% of popular musical selections on the radio have to qualify as Canadian, and they have restrictions on the amount of foreign television shows that can be shown on Canadian network and stuff like that.
That seems pretty nuts to me. I mean, I just want to stay on that for a minute because I don't know anything about this.
Right.
Like if I'm in Toronto or Montreal or whatever, there's a cap on the amount of American TV I can watch and the amount of, American songs I can listen to on the radio, and they're going to force all this Canadian stuff on me.
I guess so. Yeah.
Come on, man.
That seems to be the case. It's not so much a, I guess it is a cap on American content, but it's you know, basically they've carved out a space for Canadian artists and say that, you know, say that they own this much of the airways, and you know, you can put on foreign content for the rest, but for 35% or 50%, et cetera, you know, that's going to be for Canadian content.
I'm just trying to think, like, yeah, who are our favorite Canadian singers? Like, somebody's got to know. Do you have, like, Celine Dion, right? She's Canadian. Do they play a lot of Celine Dion up there all the time? Is it like a quota on Celine Dion that must be played at least 3 times an hour? And who else? I mean, this is a project for our producers to come up with some good sound here that will highlight the great Canadian cultural products.
Jenny, will you stop the recording, but then turn this mic on and start back up? This is mic 3.
Okay, Ben.
Yes.
Are you ready?
I'm ready for anything.
I'm going to give you the names of several musical artists. I want you to tell me honestly if you've ever heard of them.
Go.
All right. Gordon Lightfoot.
Oh, yeah. The USS Gordon Lightfoot collided with the... that's a Seinfeld episode. Yeah, I've heard of Gordon Lightfoot.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitchagumi.
Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Oh, BTO. Of course. Yeah, I know Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Snow.
Snow. Not familiar with the stylings of Snow, unfortunately, but I'm sure they're fine Canadian.
Brian Adams.
Oh, come on. Yeah, Brian Adams. I didn't even know he was Canadian, but he was a great balladeer, so I guess I can sign on for a little Brian Adams. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I don't turn him off when he comes on the radio.
How about Nelly Furtado, Avril Lavigne, and Carly Rae Jepsen?
Yeah, I've heard of all of them. I deny that any of them are Canadian. I'm about to go up to Toronto to help launch the Politico Canada initiative, which everybody should look out for. And, you know, I'm going to be outraged as soon as I cross the border and I'm forced to listen to Canadian music, and I'll tweet about it and complain about it, and maybe the Trump administration will like it. I'm feeling myself feeling more Trumpian now and being outraged over the extent to which our great cultural products, you know, like, I want to be able to listen to Eminem in Canada as much as I want to, man. All right, so let's not get too focused on this, although now I'm completely obsessed with it, and it's all I'm going to want to talk about or think about for the next few hours. All right, so let's talk about the timeline. They are meeting this week, the Canadians and the Americans. There is this general belief that a deal has to be done and submitted to the Congress, the U.S. Congress, by the end of September. Why is that? Why does it have to be done by the end of this month?
Well, the only reason it has to be done by the end of this month, a deal has to be done by the end of this month, is that the Trump administration has formally notified Congress of its intention to sign the agreement. It gets somewhat complicated, but the current Mexican president leaves office basically December 1st, and a new Mexican president comes in. And apparently the new Mexican president doesn't want to deal with NAFTA. And so the U.S. negotiators sort of use that as a way to – as leverage in the negotiations with Mexico, saying, okay, well, if you want these negotiations to end, you know, then you have to do X, Y, and Z. And so, you know, that's why they that's how they were able to close the deal with Mexico. So then they closed the deal with Mexico and tried also to close the deal with Canada before the end of August, but they weren't able to close with Canada before the end of August. I'm sorry, I said this gets complicated, and it is. But so on August 30th, I believe it was, or 31st, they notified Congress that they're going to sign the agreement with Mexico and potentially also with Canada. What they're trying to do now is complete the negotiations with Canada and any like last minute items that they have to do trilaterally with all three countries, and then get the text to Congress by the end of September, because there's another requirement in that Trade Promotion Authority law that says the text has to be published 60 days before it's signed. So that means if it's going to be signed like November 30th or November 29th, the text has to be public, you know, September 29th or September 30th, you know, whatever the exact day works out to be.
that's basically, you can dive deep into the weeds for why it has to happen, but essentially right now the timeline is the administration wants to get a text to Congress by the end of September. And it seems to me there are a couple of possible paths here. One is that the U.S. does not make a deal with Canada, and the administration simply submits to Congress a bilateral agreement with Mexico and assumes that that will be approved on an up or down vote, you know, leaving Canada out in the cold. So that's, mm-hmm. you know, sort of door one. And there's door two, which is the United States does manage to figure out these niggling issues with the Canadians between now and the end of the month and submits to Congress text of a deal, a new NAFTA with the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, and Congress approves it, and on we go with NAFTA continuing to exist, albeit in a slightly different form. And then door three is NAFTA goes away, that there simply isn't a deal. And that seems to me pretty unlikely now that we have this thing with Mexico, right? Aren't the two scenarios that are kind of before us now a bilateral U.S.-Mexico deal or a new NAFTA?
Yeah, I mean, you could be right about that. You know, several members of Congress are saying, you know, that Canada has to be part of the deal, and you're certainly hearing that from the business community as well, that they don't want to substitute a trilateral agreement with a bilateral agreement. So that would be interesting if Congress is actually confronted with that question. But as we're getting closer to that possibility, you know, some members of Congress are saying, well, you know, the president really doesn't have the right to withdraw from NAFTA all by himself. You know, the Constitution gives Congress jurisdiction over trade, and, you know, Congress had to vote to approve the agreement. So any decision to, you know, withdraw from the agreement should require congressional input as well. But it's a very murky legal question. And I was just kind of rereading a story that I wrote earlier this year, you know, where some very respected trade experts from around town were saying, yes, they think that, you know, Trump could actually withdraw from NAFTA if he wanted to. There could be a challenge in Congress to that, but the whole issue might end up in the courts, and it could take quite some time to resolve.
I'll just posit what I think the most likely scenario is, and maybe you can give me yours. I mean, I think Trump's ultimate desire is to be able to say, I renegotiated NAFTA and got a much better deal, even if the deal is actually not a whole lot better and only at the margins any different. But that's what he wants to be able to say. So I think they're motivated to get some kind of concessions from Canada and then have a new NAFTA to present to Congress and that they'll figure out a way to do that. And then Congress will approve it and we'll all go on with our lives and perhaps be able to watch more American TV in Canada and sell a little bit more milk there or whatever. Do you think that is the most likely scenario, that they do get something and Trump can then declare victory and say, I renegotiated NAFTA?
I guess I do. Yeah, I think so. I think that they'll get an agreement that will be acceptable to most members of Congress. Certainly better than dealing with the possibility of him withdrawing from the pact and all the uncertainty that has created, and also just ending the uncertainty of the ongoing negotiations, which has been, you know, detrimental for business in all three countries.
Let's talk about the personalities here for a second. You got Bob Lighthizer in the room for the Americans and Chrystia Freeland in the room for the Canadians. And also in my reporting recently, I've gotten the sense that U.S. negotiators really don't like Chrystia Freeland. They don't like that she takes shots in the media. Recently, she kind of snarked at Kudlow, saying he wasn't in the room for discussions. That didn't go over particularly well in the West Wing. And they feel like, you know, she's inflexible in the room and then kind of mean to them outside the room. Does any of that matter? Have you picked up on any of that there's kind of a pretty chilly set of relationships there? And does it make any difference that they don't like the Canadian trade official who's doing the negotiating?
Well, I think it matters to some degree. I think interpersonal relationships matter in the negotiating room. But I don't I don't know in the final analysis if it'll make a lot of difference in terms of what deal was struck or not. I mean, I've heard the same things as well, that U.S. officials aren't that fond of Chrystia Freeland, but I've never heard them publicly admit to that. I don't know. It is sort of an interesting dynamic. She's a former journalist. I've always kind of wondered, like, is she going to write a book about the NAFTA negotiations when it's all over? Sort of a tell-all story about her time with Bob Lighthizer. It would make an interesting read.
Yeah, my guess is she probably would do that. You know, she was a great journalist. She was always really good to me at the FT. But like any super ambitious person, she could rub people the wrong way and be pretty aggressive. So maybe that's what's irritating the Trump administration, or that she just hasn't caved and said, fine, you can, you know, sell all the dairy products you want into Canada and take whatever you want. So it could just be that she's tough and they don't like the fact that she's tough. But it's interesting to me that there is this kind of chilly relationship, and maybe it won't be so chilly when they finally get a deal. All right, Doug, let's do a little bit of a lightning round to close things out. Just a few questions for you on all of this. And the first one is, you know, we've had NAFTA for 24 years. Can we live without it if it goes away?
Well, I mean, can we live without it? I think, you know, I don't know. That's one of those questions. I often wonder, like, you know, would the average American really notice if NAFTA wasn't there or not? And I'm not sure. But I mean, I think that it would have a big impact on farmers, on the auto industry, on certain other industries if it were to suddenly vanish. And there would be a lot of disruption, and you would hear a lot of news about it. I personally believe that the U.S. economy wouldn't be stronger as a result of withdrawing from NAFTA. So I kind of wonder, you know, in the end, why you would want to do that. But I mean, you know, I don't think the country would collapse.
There wouldn't be blood running in the streets and people screaming and yelling and gnashing of teeth and Armageddon scenes and the horsemen of the apocalypse riding through, you know, the country. But you're absolutely right that obviously there would be impacts. It would be disruptive. The market would not like it, and automakers wouldn't like it, and supply chains would be disrupted. So, I mean, can we live without it? Sure, we can. We'll be better off without it. Heck no, I don't think so. Last note, and I'm going to ask you to play, you know, Trump interpreter, which is hard for anybody to do, but you know, you've been covering trade for over 15 years. You've seen you know, trade advisors come and go, presidents come and go. Can you help me understand how Trump sees the world, so we can all interpret what's going on with all the stuff on NAFTA? Give me your like brief summation of the Trump view of the world and how it impacts what we're talking about now on NAFTA.
Well, you know, I think he sees it as a scorecard. I mean, he sees trade as a scorecard, and the trade deficit is that scorecard. And if we have a trade deficit with another country, that means we're losing to that country. I mean, that's a view that I've heard, you know, Democratic politicians make for a long period of time. Again, it's surprising to hear it coming from a Republican president, and it's not a view that I think that, you know, most economists would agree with. I mean, we have a huge trade deficit right now, but you know, the economy is the strongest that it's been in a long time. So it would seem like that, you know, that right there sort of suggests that, like, well, a trade deficit, you know, it's not like it's crippling the economy. You know, we're growing it at more than 4%, you know, currently. But he seems to be very obsessed by that number, and most of his trade actions seemed to be aimed at trying to reduce trade deficits in one way or another. But so far, he hasn't had much success. I mean, the trade deficit this year will probably be bigger than it was last year, and last year it was bigger than the year before he took office. So, I don't know. I think that he's going to continue to be frustrated on that point, but it's going to continue to be a driving factor behind his trade policies.
You know what the answer to that is, Doug? If our trade deficit continues to go up, the answer to that is more tariffs, big, beautiful tariffs on everything, and that's going to solve the problem. I don't think anybody has any notion that that I agree with that idea that trade deficits somehow are a scorecard or a reflection on how the economy is doing. Trade deficits tend to go up when our economy is strong, and they go down when we're in recession. So thinking of them as a scorecard is ridiculous and stupid. But anyway, we've talked about that a zillion times on this podcast. We don't need to do it again now. Doug Palmer, thanks so much for unpacking all of this complicated stuff for us. Doug Palmer, you can follow him on at Trade Reporter on Twitter. You should definitely be paying close attention to what he and his colleagues at Politico are writing as we go into the endgame negotiations with the Canadians on NAFTA. And stay tuned for, I'm sure, more on NAFTA and trade and everything else on the Politico Money podcast. Doug, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
That's a wrap for this week's Politico Money. Thanks to my producer, Jenny Ament, and our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. We'll be back with you next week. Justin Bieber is Canadian? You gotta go and get angry at all of my honesty. You know I try, but I don't do too well with apologies. I hope I don't run out of time, cause someone call a referee. Cause I just need one more shot, have forgiveness. I know you know that I made those mistakes maybe once or twice. And by once or twice, I mean maybe a couple of hundred times. So let me, oh let me redeem, oh redeem all myself tonight. Cause I just need